Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, Pope Benedict celebrates Mass for the Feast of the Assumption. An auxiliary Bishop of Sydney looks back to the summer of 2008 as he talks about the unexpected and long-lasting consequences of the Australian World Youth Day. And Jill Bevilacqua presents Episode 7 of The Vatican Centuries, our dramatisation of the people and places that made up the history of the Vatican. August 15th, Feast of the Assumption of Our Lady, Pope Benedict XVI celebrates Mass in the little parish church at Castel Gandolfo, south of Rome, where the papal summer residence is located. The Pope is spending the month of August there, returning to Rome just once a week for his Wednesday general audiences. On Saturday, he also recites the Angelus Prayer for the Feast of the Assumption, with the faithful gathered in the courtyard of the Papal Palace, as he does again on Sunday. And you can find full coverage of the Pope's reflections on those two occasions on our website at www.vaticanradio.org/English. Over a year ago, in the summer of 2008, several hundred thousand young pilgrims made what proved for many of them to be one of the most significant journeys of their lives, travelling to the Australian city of Sydney for World Youth Day 2008. Pope Benedict XVI also made the journey to Australia to be with the young people, many of whom had come from all over the country, others who had travelled from different parts of the globe to join in the week of celebrations, liturgies, and the forging of new friendships for a vibrant experience of the universality of the Catholic Church. It all seems quite a long time ago now, yet for many of those pilgrims, as well as for the organisers, and even for local residents who had little or no connection to the church, the experience has had some long-lasting and unexpected consequences.
We've had some university researchers interviewing several thousand of the pilgrims, both before World Youth Day, during World Youth Day and since, and they're going to repeat that at intervals after World Youth Day to see if the effects they've found so far are lasting. But of the effects they have found, they've been very encouraging indeed.
Dominican Bishop Anthony Fisher is auxiliary in the Diocese of Sydney, and as the youngest Australian church leader, he was charged with the mammoth task of coordinating World Youth Day 2008.
More than 7 out of 10 of the pilgrims have said that this was one of the best experiences of their life, World Youth Day in Sydney, or that it's even changed their life forever. And in particular, they pointed to the experience they had of God there and of the church, that many of them found God more real, more intimate to them, more part of their life than previously, where God had been more an abstraction, I think, something their parents had told them to worship, but they didn't really feel it. And likewise, the church had seemed to them perhaps an institution, important one, but now they'd experienced its universality and that it was full of young people like themselves with the same sorts of questions and concerns and hopes for the future. The events they especially found helpful were very interesting to us. We thought it would be probably the concerts and the fun times, the party times and so on. But most of them by far said that the events that mattered most to them were the Stations of the Cross, the Vigil of Light and Testimony with the Holy Father on the Saturday night, and then the final Mass with the Holy Father on Sunday. So the principal liturgical events were also the most important to the young people, which was very interesting. And many of them said that that's one or other of those, that's where they really experienced God most intensely and intimately.
These are surveys of Australians from all over the country, or even pilgrims from other countries who came for Sydney 2008?
It's a survey of English-speaking pilgrims, so about 60% of the group are from Australia and New Zealand, and the other 40% are from the United States, Canada, Great Britain, Southeast Asia, parts of Africa that speak English.
And this survey is obviously coming up with some very positive results for you. What do you do with these results? How do you build on that experience of God that these young people had?
Well, we've also asked them what they think would be the most beneficial to them by way of follow-up after World Youth Day. We partly wanted to do this research to help future hosts because this hadn't been done before, and we thought it would have been useful to us and would be for future hosts to know what events are most important to young people, what things they'd like to see happen at World Youth Day. But for our own purposes, we wanted some feedback from them on what they'd like to see happen in the years after World Youth Day. And over half of them have told us they'd like to have opportunity for retreats and camps so they can grow more in their faith. I think many of them have taken their faith seriously for the first time at World Youth Day. They suddenly know what they don't know, and they want opportunities to deepen what they found at World Youth Day. There was a strong support for post-World Youth Day get-togethers of the pilgrims where they could share their experiences and build on their friendships. Many have asked, more than a third of them have asked for greater opportunities for youth masses in their parishes and dioceses, for opportunities to learn more about their faith through online media or through more traditional ways of learning about their faith. And so in Australia, we've been seeking to respond to those requests. We've had some of our own ideas as well, but we take very seriously what the young people have said they'd like to see by way of follow-up. And so we've already had some national youth gatherings. We've put in place youth masses in every deanery that we can, every subsection of the diocese that we can around Australia. We've built, for instance, in Sydney, a large retreat centre for young people to come for retreats and formation experiences after World Youth Day.
I imagine, by and large, though, these are children, young people who, as you say, have some experience of church, were brought up in the faith. Is there any indication from this survey that you're actually reaching people who perhaps wouldn't have had contact with the church?
I think it's true that, in fact, our researchers were surprised by how connected with the church the young people that come to World Youth Day already are. I think they had taken the general view of Gen Y, that they basically don't have much religion, don't have much connection with the church, and or perhaps much in the way of idealism. And they were surprised to find what a level they already had on their way to World Youth Day, and World Youth Day built on that and confirmed that for them. But we also have, I surveyed all the bishops of the region and asked them to ask their priests, and I've got a significant increase in the number of people joining the RCIA program, for instance. So these are people who were not Catholic, but who World Youth Day stirred up in them an interest in the faith. Some of them not in the World Youth Day demographic either, some of them are older. But we have many, many reports of conversions, so of people who one way or another have been touched by World Youth Day. One bishop told me a story of a woman who was 90 and was a confirmed agnostic, and who watched the Stations of the Cross on TV, and by the end of it she was crying. She said it was the only religious experience she'd had in her life, and she's now sought admission to the church. And we have a whole numbers of much younger people too seeking admission to the church. We've had already quite a rise in inquiries for the seminaries in Australia and New Zealand. In New Zealand, they tell us the numbers have doubled of those who've entered the seminary this year, and they put that down to the effect of World Youth Day. So already we're seeing some quite tangible effects, bigger effects than just encouraging or confirming the faith in people who already had it. These are people who have had major conversion experiences or changes in the direction of their lives as a result of World Youth Day.
You mentioned that Way of the Cross liturgy, which so many people found particularly powerful in the way that it drew on so many elements of Australian culture and the city of Sydney itself. What do you put that down to? Was it a particular desire to draw outside, if you like, what would be seen as traditional Catholic liturgy?
We were very conscious that we wanted a version of the Stations of the Cross that would include a lot of people that would not normally be seen in our churches. So, for instance, we used a scriptural version of the Stations, which meant many non-Catholic Christians would be very comfortable with it being entirely taken from the New Testament. We had discussions with the Jewish community to make sure it would not be offensive as far as possible to them. We involved a lot of people who would have very little connection normally with religion, organised religion, to get a sense of what would move them, what would help to draw them to the Catholic faith. And it certainly worked. The text is a very beautiful one. It was written by a priest who's also a poet and professor of English literature. We had a priest directing it who's used to work for Opera Australia before he entered the priesthood. And we had a group of very committed young actors, amateurs but serious about their faith, who were determined they wanted to make this a moment that moved everybody, not just the people who already are very strongly attached to the church.
You've already given, if you like, some of the secrets of your success for what seems to have been a hugely successful event there. Handing over to the Madrid team, if you like, what would be your message? What is your advice?
We sought to organise early, and I had a very good team of people working with me on planning for this World Youth Day, to learn everything we could from the previous hosts, what had worked for them and what hadn't, just as we'll be passing on to the Madrid team our reflections both on what worked for us and what didn't, what were some of the challenges, in the hope that the next hosts can learn from that. They'll make their own mistakes probably, as we did, but to at least try and not repeat the ones from the past and to build on what did work in the past. That helped us enormously. And the other thing I'd say that was hugely important was Cardinal Pell kept saying to us, I know this is going to be a wonderfully well-organised World Youth Day, but there's no point in a well-organised event that doesn't actually deeply affect people spiritually, and that we had to keep focused on the spiritual goals of World Youth Day. It's not just an entertainment, it's not just a Catholic Woodstock, as people have called it, a great gathering. That's part of it, that's part of what attracts the young people to it. But once they're there, we're very conscious that in every element of the World Youth Day week, we want to make sure it built on the themes the Holy Father had given us and built up the faith of those young people. And I'd be saying the same thing to the Spaniards, that you have a new set of themes. You have with us, though, the same goal, and that is to build up the faith of these young people who come and the others who look on. And so to keep that always in mind, whenever you're deep in the organisational issues of how many toilets you need and security and how you're going to feed, in the Spanish case, perhaps 2 million people, to always have an eye to the bigger picture of what this is about.
You talked about challenges, mistakes even, that were made. Can you tell us about any of those?
I think that one area of difficulty for us was that in our registration system and our accreditation system, that caused some real difficulty for people. They found it was a new electronic system that I think had trouble dealing with the sheer volume of people often trying to get on at the one time and to book, and as young people often tend to do, leaving it very late to book and then changing their mind repeatedly and changing their details, and people that didn't perhaps put in all their details, so they were still deciding whether they'd really come. And that meant that I think some people found some grief in trying to get onto the registration system, and likewise when they arrived, some of the priests in trying to get accredited. We discovered that many of the priests don't at World Youth Day don't tell you in advance they're priests. They hide that. And we discovered the reason is they want to stay with their pilgrim group. They're very attached to their pilgrim group and they don't want to be put into a priest's hotel or special priest's accommodation. They want to stay with their pilgrims, which is admirable. But it meant for us, on arrival, we discovered we had more than twice as many priests as we had prepared for, and we had to try and accredit them very quickly, and that turned out to be very difficult to do in a short time because we had to check that they really were priests and provide vestments and so on for them.
So a lot of logistical difficulties, perhaps. How would you say that this experience for you and for the church in Sydney has affected the role, the status of the church there, maybe with regard to government or local authorities?
I think when you talk to people in government, to the police and the various emergency services, to people in the other churches, to community groups like the Aboriginal elders and so on, group after group will tell you how very impressed they were with the Pope, but especially with the young people. That Sydney came alive with a joyfulness that it really has never experienced before. And Sydney is, in many ways, a party city. It's used to big events, it's used to having lots of fun a lot of the time, but never before had people experienced an invasion of faith and idealism and joy on the face of those young people as they saw. And one after another of these government officials and police leaders and firemen and so on have said to us, we just wished it would never end. They were a bit frightened in the lead-up to it, at the sheer scale and complexity, but when it actually happened, those young people, I think, softened even the hardest hearts. And that, I think, is an enduring legacy for the church, because it's affected people's impressions of the church. I think many people, particularly those who are not often at church, saw it as essentially old-fashioned, for old people, and they were astonished to see so many normal, happy, lovely young people there at World Youth Day, very proud of their faith, very active in their faith. And that's changed, I think, the general impression that the people in Sydney in government and secular society had of the church.
It certainly was something quite extraordinary for what is a very secular, perhaps quite cynical, very materialistic society.
We had a very hostile media in the lead-up to World Youth Day, using it as an opportunity to bash up the church in various ways. And it was fascinating to see the change once the young people arrived. It was quite infectious, and reporters who would often be pretty hard, cynical about the church and about perhaps many institutions, loved World Youth Day and said to us they were completely captivated by it themselves. When people think of big crowds of young people, I think many people think of football crowds or crowds at concerts. They think drugs, they think violence, they think there's destruction of property, old people, lock yourselves inside, don't dare go out. And for this magical week or 10 days in Sydney, everyone wanted to be on the streets of those young people. It lifted everyone's spirits.
It must be quite difficult for you coming down from that high, isn't it, and carrying on with normal life?
Yes, it was a wonderful time for us, and it's in some ways hard to let go of, even though I think we're all very proud of what was achieved, and we're pretty exhausted by the end of it, so we're happy to be passing it on to someone else to do next time. But this was, I think, the high point for the church in Australia in its history so far, in its 200 or so years. And it's something that this generation of young people will treasure for the rest of their lives.
My thanks there to Dominican Bishop Anthony Fisher, Auxiliary in the Diocese of Sydney, Australia, and coordinator of World Youth Day 2008. And now Jill Bevilacqua presents episode 7 of The Vatican Centuries, our dramatisation of the people and places that made up the history of the Vatican.
The old-time religion was dead and buried,
After Constantine, it was some time before Christianity was anything more than tolerated.
Julian the Apostate even tried to put the clock back and reinstate paganism, but he was unsuccessful.
In 391, the Emperor Theodosius finally prohibited heathen cults altogether, making the Christian faith officially the religion of the Roman state.
It is our will that all the peoples we rule should practice that religion which the divine Peter the Apostle transmitted to the Romans. We shall believe in the single deity of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit under the concept of equal majesty and of the Holy Trinity. We command that those persons who follow this rule shall embrace the name of Catholic Christians. The rest, however, whom we adjudge demented and insane, shall sustain the infamy of heretical dogmas. Their meeting places shall not receive the name of churches, and they shall be smitten first by divine vengeance and secondly by the retribution of our own initiative, which we shall assume in accordance with divine judgment.
St. Peter's was a reality, as a church and as a place of pilgrimage. But it was also a building which had arisen over a massive pagan cemetery, and only half a century after the construction was completed, the crypts beneath the floor of the basilica became flooded. The streams from the Vatican Hill had filtered down through the foundations into the tombs.
Pope Damasus I, who reigned from 366 to 384, was undismayed. He drained the hillside, managing to block the source of one of the springs, and collected the water into a subterranean basin. Two pipes drew water from this basin. One supplied the baptismal font which Damasus had built, the other flowed into the fountain, which the Pope had placed in the centre of the portico for the refreshment of pilgrims.
This fountain was a splendid affair. It consisted of a large pine cone made of bronze planted on a solid base. Water poured plentifully from its leaves and summit, and rose to quite a height before splashing down into a porphyry shell beneath. The fountain was surmounted by a bronze canopy of convex form with a cross in its centre and supported by 8 Corinthian pillars.
The baptistry built by Damasus was also surrounded by columns, probably like those of the Lateran baptistry which still exists. The chair of Peter stood in the baptistry, and here it was the bishop sat, waiting to confirm those who had just been baptised.
Pope Damasus was also responsible for putting the catacombs in order. They had fallen into disuse as places of worship now that Christians could freely build churches. Damasus was something of an archaeologist. He consolidated and enlarged the catacombs, and as he found and identified the various tombs of the martyrs, he labelled them with poetic epigraphs.
In the first centuries of the church, the Bishop of Rome was in no sense a pope, as we know popes. Even the title, Papa, was not used until the end of the 4th century, and not until the 6th century was it officially reserved for the Bishop of Rome.
The early popes were fairly shadowy figures, reacting to events but not shaping the new relationships between church and imperial government. It was under the Emperor Theodosius that a churchman first stood up to the lay power and attempted a definition of the relation of church and state. That man was Ambrose.
In the year 374, the Bishop of Milan had just died, and the people were gathered in the cathedral to elect a successor. The majority of Milanese were Catholics, but there was a strong minority of Arians. Discussion became heated and tempers flared. At the height of the uproar, a man entered the church and calmed the crowd. It was Ambrose, the governor of Liguria and Emilia, and a very popular figure. Soon the cry was heard, "Ambrose for bishop!" and it was taken up by the whole assembly.
Ambrose, who was only a catechumen, was reluctant. But the emperor upheld his nomination, and within a week he had been baptized, ordained, and consecrated bishop. He proved to be one of the greatest and most beloved pastors of all time. His people were ready to die for him. When the Empress Justina insisted that Arians be admitted to the churches, Ambrose refused point blank. Justina sent the imperial guard to see that her order was carried out. Together with the faithful, Ambrose shut himself in the cathedral, now surrounded by soldiers. The siege went on for several days, but Ambrose was unperturbed. To keep the people's spirits up, he taught them to sing.
Emperors found Ambrose a hard nut to crack. Valentinian condemned him to exile, but he ignored the order. Theodosius crossed swords with him more than once. When he did not receive the bishop, Ambrose took pen and ink and wrote, "I'm writing to you so that you will listen to me in your palace. Otherwise, I will see that I'm listened to in my church."
And he was. When Theodosius suppressed a rebellion in Thessalonica by executing 7,000 people, Ambrose forced him to do public penance before admitting him to the cathedral. "The emperor is in the church, not above the church," said Ambrose.
Ambrose was never pope, but he acted like one. And perhaps that is why even to this day the Diocese of Milan is second only to that of Rome.
Physically, Ambrose was small and delicate in health, with an aquiline nose and piercing eyes. But intellectually, there was nothing small about him. And like most truly great men, he found time for everyone. Indeed, St. Augustine, who was eventually baptized by him, grumbled that he was unable to get close enough to the bishop to pour out his heart for the troops of men full of business to whose infirmities he condescended.
"He did not forbid any man to enter," writes Augustine, "nor was it his custom to be told beforehand of such as came to speak with him." Augustine never became really intimate with Ambrose, but he attended his sermons regularly, and it was largely due to the teaching of the Greek bishop that he was finally won over to Christianity.
Both men would later be declared doctors of the Latin Church, even though, as so often happens, history has reserved to the pupil a greater glory than that of the master. As the power of the empire waned, the importance of Christian Rome grew. The shrines of Peter and Paul were drawing more and more pilgrims. And on the 29th of June each year, the Feast of the Two Apostles was marked by a solemn procession round the city, from St. Peter's to St. Paul's. The 4th century Spanish poet Prudentius made a pilgrimage to Rome and describes the atmosphere of the festival.
"An extraordinary crowd, festive, rushing. Why, my friend, is it wandering through the city, filling it with clamour and jubilation? Here we are once again at the day of the Apostles' triumph. Watch the throngs of Romans in the city squares, some going one way, some another. There are really two feasts, but the joy is one."
And Jill Bevilacqua will be back at this same time next week with episode 8 of The Vatican Centuries. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow if you can, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.